Hello and welcome to the Semantic Cybersecurity Brief, our fortnightly podcast where we discuss all things cybersecurity. I'm Dick O'Brien and joining me today once again is Semantic Threat Researcher Bridget O'Gorman. In this week's podcast, we'll be talking once again a lot about ransomware, but we'll also be looking at how attackers leverage Slack to attack one of the world's biggest gaming companies, how one of the largest online marketplaces for stolen credentials was taken down by authorities, and how law enforcement used backdoor chat apps to spy on criminals, leading to hundreds of arrests. But first, our last podcast was a special about the Conti ransomware attack that hit the health service executive here in Ireland. And it seems that ransomware attacks in general have continued to be the main story in cybersecurity news over the last couple of weeks as well.
Yeah, definitely. Ransomware just continues to dominate the headlines. And I suppose over the last couple of weeks, you've actually seen some developments related to some of the stories that we have previously discussed on the podcast as well.
Yeah, there's been a lot of things going on, including, I believe, an update in the Colonial Pipeline story.
Yeah, so in, I suppose, good news for Colonial Pipeline, the US Department of Justice announced on the 7th of June that it had recovered the majority of the ransom that Colonial had paid to the DarkSide ransomware gang in the wake of the ransomware attack that occurred in May. And the FBI was able to recover 63.7 bitcoins of the approximately 75 bitcoins that Colonial had paid to DarkSide. And when Colonial paid the ransom, it reportedly cost them approximately $4.4 million. But as Bitcoin prices had surged at that time, they've fallen back somewhat since. So the money that has been returned is worth around $2.5 million or so at the moment. And investigators said that they tracked the ransom payment across multiple Bitcoin addresses and that they were able to seize the funds after they gained access to one account's private key. Now, it's not clear how authorities were able to gain access to the private key for this wallet. However, DarkSide had claimed on the 14th of May that it had lost access to its payment servers. And this announcement, it would appear to somewhat back up that claim from DarkSide, because there was speculation at the time when the group initially announced that it was shutting down, that potentially it was pulling an exit scam and essentially doing a runner with the money. But this news would appear to show that some of its infrastructure at least was infiltrated by authorities.
Yeah, a pretty interesting development there, all right. And it's rare that somebody gets the ransom back, even if it's been affected by exchange rates. But it'll be interesting to hear exactly what went on in the background that allowed them to recover the money. And I believe there was some more news about a ransom payment recently as well, wasn't there?
Yeah, we discussed in the last podcast, as well as the HSE attack, we also talked about a ransomware attack on JBS, which is the world's largest producer of beef. And this led to disruption to some of its production sites in the US and also in Australia. And since then, JBS has confirmed that it too paid a ransom of almost $11 million to the ransomware gang behind that, which was Rebel or Southern Okibi, as we know them. And according to a statement released by the company on the 9th of June, the ransomware operators initially were looking for a ransom of a huge $22.5 million, but JBS said it ended up paying $11 million to prevent the data that was stolen during the attack from being publicly leaked, and also it said to mitigate possible technical issues. And the company's US CEO, Andre Nucera, said it was a very difficult decision, but that the company felt it had to be made in order to prevent any potential risk to their customers. So that's a serious payday there for the attackers.
I know. Even though they kind of seem to have bargained them down to 50% of the original demand, 11 million is not to be sneezed at. And ransoms like this being forced out of companies, it's probably no surprise now that we're seeing quite a lot of political reaction to these attacks.
Yeah, I mean, the intervention of the US authorities in retrieving the majority of the Colonial ransom, you know, was notable, because as you said, Dick, it's quite unusual really for, you know, to get these kind of ransoms returned. And it was actually the first operation by the new Ransomware and Digital Extortion Task Force, which the US authorities said they've established in order to investigate, disrupt and prosecute ransomware and digital extortion activity. And in the last week as well, we've also seen cybersecurity discussed at the G7 summit that was held in Cornwall in the UK at the weekend. And in a communique following that summit, the G7 group of nations specifically called on Russia to crack down on the ransomware gangs operating within its borders. And the G7 group, which is made up of the governments of the US, the UK, France, Germany, Japan, Canada and Italy, said that it had committed to working together to urgently address what is described as the escalating shared threat from criminal ransomware networks. And it called on all states to urgently identify and disrupt ransomware networks operating in their borders and to hold them accountable before specifically urging Russia to identify, disrupt and hold to account those within its borders who conduct ransomware attacks and other cybercrimes. So that was quite a strong statement from them. And then following that, the NATO group of countries, which held a summit on just Monday past, also agreed that the organization's Article 5 provision, which states that an attack on one member nation is an attack on all, could now also be applied to cyber attacks, whereas prior to this it was generally just applied to, you know, physical attacks, terrorist attacks, that kind of thing. And a communique following that summit said that NATO recognised that the impact of significant malicious cumulative cyber activities might in certain circumstances be considered as amounting to an armed attack, which is again quite a strong statement and not probably something we've heard before. And NATO also said that it would employ its full range of capabilities to deter, defend against and counter cyber threats. So it's very clear that governments globally are now really taking cybersecurity seriously following, you know, the number of significant ransomware attacks we have seen particularly lately. And even prior to these recent post-summit announcements, I suppose, the US had also said a few weeks ago that it was now going to, you know, rate basically investigations into ransomware attacks at a similar level to investigations into terrorist incidents.
Yeah, there really seems to be serious upping of the ante across the board. And have we seen anything from the ransomware gangs themselves? Is there any indication of what their reaction is like? You know, have they been spooked?
Well, I mean, obviously we saw the shutdown DarkSide, I suppose. So that was the kind of initial reaction we saw to some of this activity. And I suppose, interestingly, we've kind of seen two contrasting responses from two different ransomware gangs as well. So the Abaddon ransomware gang appears to have shut down its operations after it sent almost 3,000 decryption keys to the news website Leapy Computer last Friday, allowing for a decryption tool to be developed for its ransomware. And Abaddon was first seen in February 2019, but it had ramped up its efforts significantly recently and had become one of the, you know, most prolific posters really of victim data to its extortion site, and have been linked to a string of recent attacks in the US as well as Australia. And it is possible that this recent increased attention from law enforcement made the Abaddon operations a bit nervous, potentially leading them to, you know, make the decision to shut down, to kind of take the money and run, as it were, I suppose. However, of course, it is also possible that the group has simply decided to maybe lie low for a while before maybe coming back, rebranding and then coming back to the ransomware game, which also could be what DarkSide is up to as well. You can never really be sure with ransomware gangs. Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, however, the Rebel Southern Akibi gang has actually said that, following on from all these kind of pronouncements from governments and the like, it is planning to double its focus on targets in the US, having allegedly been avoiding targets there since the Colonial incident. The gang came out a couple of weeks ago and said that every entity in the US is now open to being targeted by them.
Oh, that's a fighting talk from them.
Yeah.
On the subject of ransomware, actually, our boss, Adam Bromwich, published an interesting piece on our blog this week where he basically called for a change of approach about ransomware.
Okay, and what was the main thrust of that piece?
Well, he said a few interesting things. I think it was written in the light of the HSE attack, and it drew attention to the fact that after a lot of major ransomware incidents such as this, the attention often focuses on the victim and people ask whether they had done enough to secure their network. And, you know, while there's an obvious duty of care on the part of any organization to secure themselves, you know, solely or mostly focusing the attention on the victim does kind of get away from the wider issue of why ransomware has become so ubiquitous and so dangerous. So aside from the fact that, you know, overzealous public criticism only encourages more victims to quietly capitulate and pay, it also, it just draws away attention from the true perpetrators. And one thing in particular he said that we were very concerned about was how ransomware attacks were now beginning to resemble almost a professional transaction, a cost of doing business, where ransom payments are like not the measure of last resort, because we know in some cases that they are, you know, that it is the last resort, but a measure of first resort, where the ransom is paid sometimes because the cost of the ransom is calculated at being lower than the short-term cost of restoring the victim's IT systems from backup, or because indeed the ransom payment is covered by cyber insurance. And he said, you know, cyber insurance really should be there to compensate the victims and not reward the attackers. And even if premiums go up, the payout should go to victims, not ransomware gangs. And I guess, you know, to come back to what you asked, the trust was, it's really just, it's all about cutting off the supply of money to the attackers. And he said that governments can also play a role here. And that's just not like kind of lending advice to organizations or indeed collaborating with law enforcement, but extending as far as direct technical and financial support to victims with the aim of getting them back on their feet as soon as possible. And anything really to disincentivize the payment of ransoms, to keep them down to the bare minimum.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, I mean, this is the issue. If the criminals are profiting from this kind of activity, you know, they're going to continue carrying it out. And
that's exactly, it's not going to stop the attack attempts. They're not going to stop, you know. So I think it's an important point. Moving away from ransomware, but I think staying on the subject of extortion, you were looking at a new campaign. This has kind of gone back to the old school thing of threatening businesses with DDoS attacks.
Yeah, as you say, it's not ransomware, but I suppose, yeah, the extortion element is the same as it. So a cybercrime group calling itself Fancy Lazarus launched a new email-based extortion campaign last week, threatening, as you said, to mount distributed denial of service attacks against businesses unless they paid a ransom. Now, according to Proofpoint, which has been investigating this group since August last year, this group has operated under various guises and usually borrowing the names of well-known APT actors like Lazarus and Fancy Bear or Mazda Collective. And it's not thought that this group is linked to any of these groups, but it's likely to use similar names so that the threats are taken seriously and probably, you know, in order to kind of intimidate victims into paying a ransom if they think they're being victimized by Lazarus or one of these kind of well-known attack groups. And in its latest campaign, the group threatens to mount a DDoS attack against a target in 7 days if a ransom is not paid. And to prove their intent and capabilities, the attackers say they will mount a smaller attack against a specific IP address to sort of show what they're capable of. And it is an interesting tactic. It certainly doesn't require the sort of sophistication that we see in, you know, targeted ransomware attacks that we generally see these days. The attackers want to be paid before they carry out the attack, so, you know, potentially they can make money without really having to do too much. But on the other hand, it's very unlikely they will achieve the kind of major paydays that we're seeing ransomware attackers achieve at the moment. But yes, it's kind of bit of a throwback extortion attack, I suppose.
Indeed, yeah. And that story reminds me of something I spotted earlier on this week, which is that the Evil Corp cybercrime gang, who are behind such threats as Drydex and then more latterly, more recently, Wasted Locker, apparently they have been renaming their ransomware to Payload Bin in some recent attacks. Now, Payload Bin is ransomware that is developed by another group. I think they're the same group who were behind the Bad Book ransomware. So why were they stealing their name? Well, apparently, Evil Corp is subject to Treasury Department sanctions. And, you know, obviously, if you get infected by their ransomware and you pay a ransom, there is the concern that you may be violating those sanctions by paying money to the gang. So what they're doing, apparently, is, you know, letting the victim believe they've been infected by another ransomware gang that isn't subject to sanctions in the hope, I guess, of improving their odds of successful ransom payment. So if anyone's lucky to be infected by something called Payload Bin, it could be the real people or it could be them. But either way, it's ransomware.
anything they can do to increase your chances of getting paid, I suppose.
On one level, it probably sends a signal that the sanctions are actually working. You know, if they,
that's true,
they weren't worried about the impact of the sanctions, they wouldn't be doing this.
Yeah, very true, actually. And this next one actually sounds interesting, Dick. You found that attackers were using Slack to compromise EA games.
Yeah, I thought this was one we ought to discuss because there's a growing number of organizations these days who use Slack as one of their primary communications channels. Indeed, like, I'm aware of more than a few workplaces where Slack has all but supplanted email for internal communications. So I guess it stands to reason that attackers are going to start seriously looking at Slack as a way of getting into organizations.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense. So what happened in this case?
Yeah, well, I guess before I go any further, we should probably stress that the attacks didn't involve anything in the way of a vulnerability in Slack itself. It was really more of a case of good old-fashioned social engineering. So what happened? Well, last week, a group of hackers claimed that they had obtained a significant amount of data from EA Games. That included source code for FIFA 2021, along with source code and tools for their Frostbite engine, which powers a number of EA games, such as Battlefield, along with a bunch of other intellectual property. So EA Games, yet they confirmed that they'd experienced a breach and that they were mounting an investigation. And then this week, a few more details emerged about the attack, mainly due to the attackers themselves, which is a rare enough thing, speaking to a reporter from Motherboard. They claimed that the attack began when they purchased stolen cookies, and they said it cost them as little as $10. And they used these to gain access to EA Slack. And then once they were onto the Slack, the social engineering kind of started in earnest. They messaged IT support, and they said they'd lost their phone at a party the previous night. And could they give them a multi-factor authentication token in order to gain access to EA's corporate network? And the attackers said that this tactic actually worked for them twice. Then they found a service that was used for compiling games and used it to create a virtual machine that gave them apparently more visibility into the network. And then they accessed one more service and they were able to download a load of source code.
Right, okay. But I suppose all of this is coming from the attackers themselves. So do we have any indication if their claims are accurate or not?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question, because you always have to take these claims with a pinch of salt. So Motherboards, they said that the representative for the attackers provided screenshots to kind of corroborate their story about the various steps in the attack, including screenshots of the Slack chats themselves. And I guess more importantly, EA themselves then confirmed to Motherboards that the outline of the description of the breach given by the hackers was correct.
Right, okay, so it does look like it's pretty accurate then. Mm-hmm. So I guess with this, what are the takeaways, I suppose, for Slack users here?
It's thought-provoking. I think there's a few things to consider. First of all, I think there's the issue of how they got in the first place, and maybe there isn't as great an awareness as there should be about the role cookies can play in some cases storing login details for particular users and allowing an attacker on impersonating that person. So obviously, if you are using Slack in an organization, you need to lock it down as much as possible, using things like multi-factor authentication. And secondly, I guess people often think of Slack as something of a walled garden, and that everyone in there is automatically part of your company. And I think, you know, people need to consider it in the same bracket as email, and maybe be wise to the risk of impersonation and social engineering. Because we all know about the threats from email, but maybe we should start applying that thought process to other communications channels.
Yeah, I think that, yeah, people's kind of walls aren't as high when it comes to chat apps and things like Slack. You kind of think of it as a separate thing and not something you need to be kind of worrying too much about.
Yeah, Yeah, I mean, especially in the days of remote working, it's sort of tantamount to office chat of, you know, leaning over your partition to someone, but it's a little bit different. Now, one of the other cyber trends of 2021, aside from ransomware, that is, has been law enforcement takedowns. And you have spotted another one recently, Bridget, haven't you?
Yeah, so I mean, there's definitely been a few this year. We've discussed some of those botnet and other takedowns on the podcast already this year, I think. And recently it was announced that now I'm not sure how to pronounce this, Slip, the largest online marketplace.
Your guess is as good as mine.
Yeah. I hate these misspellings, it's just annoying. But it was the largest online marketplace basically for stolen credentials, and it has been seized by authorities and taken offline. So the US Department of Justice announced on June 10 that it had been involved in a multinational operation with authorities from Germany, the Netherlands, and Romania to take down the infrastructure of the online marketplace. So this marketplace, Slip, have been active since 2012, and according to the Department of Justice, in that time, it had sold more than 80 million login credentials for more than 1,400 companies, leading to what it said were losses of over $200 million in the US alone, with authorities also saying that the full impact of the marketplace wasn't yet known, really, the kind of impact it might have caused on businesses. And Slip was used by cyber criminals to buy and sell stolen login credentials for things like banks, online payment providers, mobile phones, retailers, and other online accounts. And did see a boost in users in recent years when other similar marketplaces were shut down. And authorities also said that more than a dozen individuals have actually been arrested in the US as well for activities linked to this marketplace as well. So it was pretty significant takedown there recently.
A whopping number of credentials apparently that changed hands on us, you know.
Yeah, crazy. And on the subject of takedown stick, there was another one recently as well involving encrypted chat apps.
Yeah, and this is kind of a fascinating story. We all know at this stage about the advent of end-to-end encryption, and it has been a massive boon to end-user privacy. But unfortunately, an unfortunate consequence really is that it sometimes has made it's easier for criminals to communicate with one another. And occasionally it's put governments and law enforcement agencies on the one hand, and then software companies and privacy rights groups on the other at loggerheads. And there's sometimes been, I guess, overly crude policy proposals, such as asking developers to effectively backdoor their apps, lest law enforcement need to get access to them and monitor users. And of course, the counterpoint to proposals like that is that it undermines privacy for everyone, and any inbuilt weakness in an app or a service can be exploited by the bad guys as much as it can by the good guys. So that's the background to it. But what happened in this case is that you occasionally get encrypted apps, or indeed entire kind of services, that are by and large just used by criminals. And indeed, they're often marketed in a fairly unsubtle way as being for that purpose. So one of these services was called Anom. That's a zero instead of an O in the spelling. And there was a major operation launched against users of it, which led to hundreds of arrests, the seizure of 32 tons of drugs, hundreds of firearms, 55 luxury cars, more than 148 million in cash, and even such exotic items as cocaine-filled pineapples. So how did they do it? Well, the FBI, they just released details of what was behind the operation. And the starting point was actually very simple, because they developed the service themselves. For the first time, the FBI developed and operated its own hardened encryption device company called Anom, said Randy Grossman, who is the acting U.S. attorney for the Southern District of California. So the entire operation stemmed from an older operation against quite a similar service called Phantom Secure. And essentially what the FBI did was they recruited one of Phantom's developers in something, I guess, like a plea bargain deal. And they created Anom from the ground up for the FBI. And I guess snooping on any users is going to be pretty easy when you develop and indeed operate the service yourself. And reading through the details of the case, it sounded like it succeeded beyond their wildest dreams, because Anom actually became internationally successful. And it got to the point where they were tipping off other international police forces about things like drug shipments and whatnot. And ironically, a European law enforcement operation against a similar service called EncroChat last year provided a boost in business for Anom, because unsuspecting former EncroChat users actually switched to Anom instead when it was shut down.
Well, I mean, this is really like, you know, this is kind of the spy movie stuff that you hear about. Mm-hmm. And it does really sound like law enforcement hit the jackpot with this operation, doesn't it?
Yeah, they really did. Apparently, in total, they netted more than 27 million messages from 100 different countries between around 300 criminal gangs. And by the sounds of it, they got so much information that they could be years prosecuting all of the potential cases. And much more than that, I think it's also a kind of strikes a real psychological warfare blow, for want of a better word, because I think now criminals, that they probably thought they could operate with impunity on these kinds of services. And now they're always going to be second guessing themselves of whether, you know, law enforcement has actually cracked the app, or whether indeed they even own it themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. They'll be wondering, is anywhere safe for kind of illegal carries on?
Indeed, yeah. Okay, well, that's it for this week. That's all of our talk on ransomware and police takedowns. But if you've been enjoying our podcast, don't forget to subscribe to avoid missing out on all of our future episodes. You can also follow us on Twitter at threatintel, or medium at medium.com/threat-intel. If you'd like to read our latest research, check out our blog, which can be found at semantic-enterprise-blogs.security.com/blogs/threat-intelligence. We'll be back again in 2 weeks' time. But until then, thank you and goodbye.